Good morning. As there always is, there's wonderful energy. We're going to take just a second with some housekeeping matters that Jim is going to share, and then I'll come back and say how glad I am to see you all.
Good morning. Thanks for making the trip to Sacramento. Just a few housekeeping items. One, restrooms are just down the hall and on the left-hand side. During the lunch break, there are restaurants. If you go out the front door to the left, there's a variety of different restaurants available. For the task force members that are here, if you need a travel expense form, Francis has those at the table by the door. And with that, I'll turn over to Secretary Dooley.
Thanks, Jim. And to Francis, they all make this meeting work, and I am very glad to be here. I'm looking around at all of the faces that I recognize. We have a few new folks that I'm looking forward to getting acquainted with. And so before I make my opening comments and we get into the meat of the meeting, we will do as we always do, go around and remind ourselves who we are and introduce ourselves to the new folks in the room. And then do we have people on the phone today, Jim?
Yes.
Okay. So when we get around the room and those present, we'll invite those of you on the phone to introduce yourselves. And a caution again, please leave your phones on mute when you're not speaking, and never, ever put them on hold. I think there's less hold music that's out there, but when it happens, we have to disconnect everyone and reconnect because we can't talk through the music. So please be sensitive about not putting your phone on hold. So I'm Diana Dooley. I'm the Secretary of Health and Human Services and have been chairing this task force for, 4 years, 5? I mean, we've been together quite a long time, and I want to talk a little bit about where we've been and where we're going before we start the agenda further. But to my left is Trustee Chris Kent. He pulls the heavy oars along with Nancy Bargeman, the director of the department. So we'll start with Nancy and go around the room.
Nancy Bargeman, Director of the Department of Developmental Services.
John Durrell, I'm in.
And just a reminder, there are two blue lights on your little devices. One is always on, but then there's one that only goes on when you push the button to speak. So if you'd be sure to do that and then turn it off when you're not speaking. Thank you.
Brian Winfield, Deputy Director for the Community Services Division of the Department of Developmental Services.
Marty Yamoto, family member, CDCAN, California Disability Senior Community Action Network, and the California Person-Centered Advocacy Partnership.
Mark Barr, SEIU Local 1000.
Christine Mall, I am a college professor at California State University, Fresno, and I'm the mother of a young man who continues to successfully transition from TDC to a community group home.
Lori McCarran, Executive Director of ARC Fresno.
Will Sabre, Futures Explored.
Good morning, Catherine Flake, Disability Rights California.
Dana Hooper, Executive Director of Life Services Alternatives.
Good morning, Aaron Carruthers, Facilitating Councilmember Keisha Weller.
Good morning. My name is Keisha Weller, representing the State Council on Developmental Disabilities.
Good morning, Carol McKinney, Harmony Home Associated.
Boy Bradshaw, Res Coalition Parent. Residential care provider.
Ron Cohen, UCP of LA.
Carlos Flores.
Executive Director of San Diego Regional Center.
Heather Flores, Executive Director of Central Valley Regional Center.
Fernando Pena for Regional Center.
Chris Scott, here to help Fernando out with his everyday needs.
Great, thanks, Chris. And on the phone, do we have council members or task force members, rather, present to identify yourselves?
Catherine McCoy, Quality Assurance, Golden Gate Regional Center.
Hi, Catherine. Anyone else?
Maybe all right now.
Great, thank you. And then we will have an opportunity, I think the agenda says public comment at the end of the agenda, but has become my practice to, just before we break for lunch, to give an opportunity for public comment at that point in the day in case there are those who are only able to be with us in the morning and they have their opportunity to have public comment. So we will do that just before we break for lunch. Well, as always, this is one of my favorite activities. This has been a wonderful journey that we've been on together, and certainly there are many challenges left ahead, but as we get to this point in the administration, and as most of you know, I've got two periods of government, one with Brown 1.0 and one with Brown 2.0, and the rest I was in the private sector, and I'm eager to complete this term in another year and a half. But as we do, it is very, very important that we transition. And so I have started a process of looking at what have we achieved, where are there gaps, how can we use the remaining 18 months to solidify the progress that we've made and do everything we can to pass the baton and turn the keys over to the next administration in a stronger place than where we were and with a clear sense of purpose and objectives that they can take and continue to enhance the services for this very important part of California's population. I was lucky enough to know Assemblyman Frank Lanterman. Uncle Frank was an extraordinary leader, and I have been so humbled and honored to have the opportunity to participate in this work that we've done over the last 6.5 years. I'm also so grateful and proud of the team that Nancy and John have put together at the department to take the work that we've done together here with this agency-sponsored task force and incorporate it into the routine work, as we'll see in the agenda today, with our state budget and the updates and the work plans. This is now in the department, and I think and I hope that if not this group, some group similarly constituted will continue to advise in a broad way the work of the department, having started in the very immediate need to have a plan for the closure of the hospitals. And indeed, as you'll recall, when we joined together, it was about the future of those centers without an acknowledgement that they may indeed need to close. And together we have worked through the federal issues and the state issues and the community issues in a transparent and inclusive way that just is the best of how working for the people can be and government at its best. And so I am looking now to assist in that incorporation of not only the work we've done, but the style with which we have done it to assure that we will have the opportunity to hear the right voices and respond openly and candidly and as objectively as we can. And I think that that is ever so much more important in the drama that we see around us from Washington, D.C., with more polarization than ever, less respect for the facts and each other. And so, again, there are many ways that I think we are proud to be Californians in leadership. I was just so delighted to see the success yesterday with the cap and trade, not just for the result itself, but for the process that brought people together, and it became a bipartisan result. result. And I think what I'm often asked about the differences working for Jerry Brown in the 70s and working for him today, and he is ever so much more committed to the actual process of government, the recognition that we have to do things together and we've got to work for that. And ideas are important, but implementing them and being pragmatic about implementing them and being responsible stewards is important. So it's too early for a swan song. We have a lot of work to do, and goodness knows he is not interested in being a lame duck, or as he so profoundly said the other day in the hearing, he has no interest in legacy. This isn't about, he said, this isn't about me, I'm going to be dead. It's about you. We will be working up until and including January 2nd of 2019. But I did want to just set the stage for how we can work together to help the department be ready to move to the next administration. I'm so glad, Keisha, that you're back with us. Keisha had a little leave of absence for a while, and she and I communicated by email. She's doing such important work in violence prevention, and I'm so proud. And I could actually say something about every one of you around the table. I have just come to respect. Mark, I haven't seen you in a while. I'm glad you're back with us. Christine, the success of your son is just gives me chills every time I see you. This has been a really important part of my work to be with you and to continue to move the ball forward. So with that, I'm going to let Chris kick off the updates, and I guess ping pong between Chris and Nancy and John. But anyway, just a very heartfelt thank you to you all, and very proud of what we've done together.
Good morning, everybody. This is Chris Kent. Have a lot of updates, some more budget-related and some related to the work of the task force. And then after that, I think we can sort of get into our last work group and then really get into comments on the actual final report. So with that, I'll turn it over to Nancy and John.
If we have, we're going to add another person or a few to our ping pong match. So we're going to start with John, and then we'll continue with the updates. And so forgive us as we kind of do some changing of folks for some of the updates.
Good morning, everyone. My name is John Doyle. I'm the Chief Deputy at Developmental Services. Just wanted to give you a quick update on a couple of items. One, where things landed with our budget, and the second will be on the rate study that we're currently working on. The final approved budget for 2017-18 ended up at $6.9 billion. This represents an overall increase to the department's budget from the 16-17 fiscal year of 4.2%. The total general fund budget has landed at $4.2 billion, and this also represents an overall increase of 4.8% compared to 2016-17. Our community services division, where our regional centers are funded, is budgeted for a total of $6.4 billion, with $3.8 billion of that coming from the general fund. The developmental centers are projected at about $466 million next year, and $348 million of that will come from the general fund. There were two significant adjustments that were included in the final approved budget. The first was a one-time increase of $7.5 million general fund, $21.2 million approximately total funds, to begin the implementation of the community safety net, which is going to be discussed later in the agenda. The second item was an augmentation of $5.6 million general fund, $10.3 million total funds, to remove the limit for respite services effective January 1st, 2018. Respite is currently limited to 90 hours per quarter, and that limit is going to be lifted, as I said, effective January 1st. The 2018-19 costs for this are projected at $11.7 million general fund and $21.6 million ongoing, so total funds. The other issue that I wanted to mention related to the budget was one of the items in the trailer bill. AB 107 is the Developmental Services Trailer Bill, and you're going to be hearing more today during the discussion about what some of the language contained in that trailer bill. But there is one item that I wanted to bring to your attention because it's not really pertinent to today's discussion, but the trailer bill does require that the department convene a health and safety rate adjustment work group. So the intent of the work group is going to be to look at ways to streamline the health and safety exemption process and to look at other recommendations on different criteria and procedures that could be considered for rate adjustments. And that we're required to report the findings of this work group as part of the 2018-19 budget process. The next issue I wanted to talk about is the rate study that we were required to complete under ABX21. We're required to submit a rate study to the legislature by March 1st of 2019. We have awarded the contract to Burns and Associates. The contract is funded for a maximum amount of $2.6 million approximately, and it runs through June 1st of 2019. We are scheduled to have our initial meetings with Burns and Associates. This is just going to be the initial meeting is going to be a department agency and Department of Finance meeting. That is scheduled for the week of August 7th, and it's the meetings are scheduled for a day and a half. There's a lot of information that Burns is looking for from us. They want to get a better understanding of how the delivery system works in California, current issues that are confronting the system. They want to get a better understanding of some of the issues that are confronting providers as well. So these are the things we're going to be talking with them about initially, and then they're going to be going out and doing a provider survey, and they're going to be meeting with this task force as well. So that's kind of an update on both the budget and the rate study. So if there's any questions, happy to answer. Thank you.
The next update. Regarding D.C. closures, certainly the work that this task force and the D.C. task force, the work that you all did has been really instrumental in where we are today. Hi, Connie. I wanted to share, we went to Fairview yesterday with a couple of the executive team at the department. And standing there and talking and giving an update to the staff and sharing some of the information that we had, it really helped me kind of get back to saying that I'm going to be reporting on numbers. So when we take a look at a closure update, oftentimes when we're reporting out to whatever community body it is, we're talking about, well, what is the current closure pop? How many individuals have transitioned? And I guess it was a time also to be able to share with staff, and I want to continue to say this, is that while we may be talking about what the numbers are, we're really talking about individuals that are changing their living option. They're moving from a developmental center, they're having a significant change in their life, and they're going to move in the community. And so, again, it was a time to just talk to the staff and say, you know, this is a hard time for families, it's an exciting time for families, it's a challenge for individuals who are transitioning, it's an exciting time for individuals that are transitioning, and same with staff, and the important work that the staff are doing at the developmental seminar to be able to help share what the preferences and likes and things that a person does that makes them happy are all the things that are helping us take the steps that we're doing in getting to the numbers and the transitions and achieving the closures based on what we have. So just kind of wanted to share that a little bit. And watching the faces of the staff, you could see the connections that they have with the relationships that they've had for a long time. So currently, as far as the closure population, as of July 12th, we have a statewide closure population of 531 individuals. At Sonoma, 255, Fairview, 161, and at Porterville, 115. So when we take a look at the transitions that are going to be projected for this next year, we have, for Sonoma, we're projecting 184 individuals that will be transitioning from Sonoma to the community, Porterville, 32, and Fairview, 93. All of those numbers include what was projected in the budget, but then also for any of the transitions that did not occur in the prior fiscal year. When we take a look at what didn't occur in the prior fiscal year, most of the transitions that did not achieve what was anticipated had to do with Fairview, and that related primarily to the resources being available. So when we take a look at where the resources are in development right now, we do see that this next year that we will be achieving the transitions, you know, and certainly as we did last year, as we have more information, we'll continue to be able to update everybody on those transitions. Part of what was helpful with Sonoma in developing markers and milestones that needed to happen as far as the development of resources, because I always say you can absolutely expedite development. You know, careful transitions of individuals is really important, but we can make sure that we put pressures on and establishing markers that we need to achieve. And we did that. So for all of the homes being developed for Sonoma, all but one community crisis home has already been acquired. It's in the process of renovation. When we take a look at total housing development for the closure, for all three developmental centers, there's 203 homes that have been identified that will support individuals transitioning to the community. This achieves a capacity of 781. We recognize that 781, you know, much of those have already been identified. Folks have transitioned to those homes or will be. There will be additional capacity available for other individuals in the community that would need services similar to those that are transitioning from a developmental center. To just give you an idea of the breakdown of that, though, is for Fairview, there are 61 homes total that are being developed. Porterville, 33 homes. Sonoma, 109. Only 37 out of the 203 homes right now are in property search. So we have 26 homes at Fairview right now that are still in property search. We've worked with the regional centers for both that have individuals that are at Porterville and at Fairview, and they're anticipating and the target is to have every single home acquired by December of this year. As we move forward, we're also starting to see more activity with individuals that are going to be receiving supports through supported living services. While it's still a lower number, we are seeing where some of the contracts, the regional centers awarded, and then also working with existing supported living providers, that those transition planning meetings are occurring. Just a real quick update on the Community State Staff Program. We are seeing an increase of participation in the Community State Staff Program. We have increased contracts. As of June 30th, we have 36 statewide community state staffs that are identified for work in the community. 22 are currently working in the community. We have 14 that are still at a developmental center that, as the individuals are transitioning, they too will transition to the homes and providing supports to the individuals in the homes. As of June 30th, we've had the increase of contracts. Currently, we have 6 total contracts for a total of 75 positions. 36 of those positions are filled and 39 are available to be filled. So just that's a real quick update on the closure. Again, with all the work that everybody's done with the supports of the development of the enhanced behavioral supports homes and then also community crisis homes, we've been able to really focus on adding to those transitions. Also focuses on supporting the non-residential services, so making sure that as we're developing employment, medical services. We're seeing the alignment coming in. Some of the day services are a little slower in being developed than the residential. If there's a need to be able to make sure that there's an individualized support for a day service while their identified day service is being finalized, those accommodations are being made through the transition planning meetings. So a lot of good things that are happening, and look forward to giving you more updates as we go. Any questions on the closure? Connie?
I love, of course, Connie Lathan. I guess we don't get lunch.
Yeah, we do. You just have to share.
I wasn't here for you
to take it away. I read somewhere, because I got this information just yesterday, that I'm thrilled to hear supportive living being an option. Can you have data on how many are going in there? I think I read somewhere where it's hard to calculate, or maybe I got mixed up with what I've read.
Yeah, it's not hard to calculate the number of individuals going from a developmental center to supported living options. We will track that. What is hard to calculate is how much is being developed or available. Because when you're taking a look at supported living services, there's not a licensed capacity. So if you have 10 supported living providers that a regional center is working with to transition somebody, the capacity is endless. So that's the part that can't be identified, but we can track how many people are selecting supported living as an option.
Are you finding that you're having difficulty finding supported living agencies?
I've not heard that from the regional centers. I don't know if Carlos or Heather has, because supported living services has been an option for individuals in the community, and so they're existing. We also have a number of supported living providers that are a part of the community placement plan. So where there have been gaps, it's been over the last 2 years, there's been funds to help support additional capacity and providers. So I've not heard the challenge of identifying providers.
Because I'd be interested to hear, the fund capacity aspect. If someone's in a wake overnight or they need more intense services, if that's a deterrent. Because I know that in the community, there are supported living agencies that just won't handle people with more severe challenges because of the added expenses they're not getting.
Right. And just within, like with any of the other services, if there is, the rate for the supported living is not enough to support the individual needs of the individual transitioning out, prior to somebody who's transitioning from the developmental center, the regional center can work with the department and the provider to design a rate that meets the health and safety and supports the individual. So those are the things that can occur before somebody transitions to the community from a developmental center.
Would there ever be a time when IHSS was not used as a generic support?
It's all based, generic supports still need to be met, but based on the IPP and what's needed for the individual, if the design is that the IHSS is not an appropriate support, that there needs to be a different level of support, those are the things that are defined through the IPP, and it's established and services are provided.
Okay, so it can be an option.
Yeah, there's times when you may have somebody who has 30 hours of IHSS because that's what's appropriate for the personal supports, and then the rest of the hours are supported living. So it's what's possible is really designing it through the IPP process to meet the needs of the person.
Yeah, Keisha. Well.
Keisha?
Please. Thank you so much. My question is, for example, coming out of the developmental centers, how are mentally fragile individuals coming out of the DCs being supported transitioning into the community? And my second question is, what is property search?
Great question. So let me start with the property search, and I'm going to go then to your question about individuals with complex medical needs. Property search, so when I was talking about the 203 homes that are being supported, they're being developed through community placement plans. So the last 3 years, there's been dollars available for a community placement plan. So the regional center can work with their provider or a nonprofit housing group to develop a house, acquire, renovate it to meet the needs of the individuals that are going to be moving in, and then the service provider can have it licensed. So it can meet all of the requirements. So property search is the point when the regional center has awarded to a nonprofit housing or a housing developer to develop the house, or the service provider is finding their own home, it's the time in which they're looking for the property before it closes escrow and renovation started. So that's what we're calling property search.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much.
So then regarding the complex medical needs, quite back in 2005-ish is when the Senate Bill 962 gave the authority to develop adult residential facilities for persons with special health care needs. And it was expanded to the that was for the closure of EGNUS. And so it, the design of the home is very much earmarked for individuals with very complex needs. And it was expanded for the purpose of Lanterman closure, and then eventually we expanded it statewide for anybody who's currently in a developmental center. So we have, I don't have the number off the top of my head as far as how many homes are being developed, but I can tell you every person that is in a developmental center today that is transitioning to the community, that we have enough adult residential facilities for persons with special health care needs. We call them ARFPSHNs. We have enough ARFPSHNs and capacities to meet every person's need. And to make sure that we're really careful, because people's medical needs change over time, mm-hmm. is that we're developing additional capacity. So over the next year or two, if there's changes in conditions and somebody does need that level of care, that we're going to have the ability to meet their needs as well.
That's excellent. Thank you so much for answering my questions for me.
Thanks, Keisha.
We'll stand for Patients Explored. This is sort of a combo question for probably John and Nancy, because in the Budget Act, there was also the language that started to open the community placement plan, moving it so that community development could also happen. So what's the department's thoughts or process on how that's going to proceed
right. As
we move forward?
With the community placement plan, as we had anticipated for 17-18, the majority of the dollars for startup were still going to be needed for the closure of the developmental centers and for individuals with a very complex needs. So we're at the point where we're going to be approving for the regional centers and then notifying where we need to say we've reached the development that we need for the purposes of the closure. What we're trying to reconcile today is then what's left now, so then we can work with the regional centers, give them the guidelines as far as then having their meetings and meeting the requirements that we need to make sure that as we expand it. This year is going to be a very thin year. Part of it has to do is that we have earmarked the safety net dollars through CPP. We still have additional supports that we need to finish in the development for the closure. So at the end of that, then we'll see what's left, and then we'll make sure that we get that communication out. Yeah. You're welcome. Additional questions? Okay, thank you. So the next update is on the enhanced behavioral supports homes and community crisis homes and disparity funding, and so Brian Winfield will provide you that update.
Okay, good morning. So because the enhanced behavioral support homes and the community crisis homes were developed as a result of the DC task force work, we wanted to provide you with an update on the development of these resources. The enhanced behavioral supports homes, we initially started off with emergency regulations, and we now have promulgated final regulations for the homes. And proud to say that the first home opened in June down in Visalia. And Mario Alvarez is here. He's the provider of the first enhanced behavioral supports home. Currently, there are four individuals residing in that home and doing really well from all accounts. The rates for the community crisis homes and the enhanced behavioral supports homes are unique. They have both a facility rate, and they also have an individual rate for each person who resides in the home. So those homes and the rate structure comes through the department, and the department is required to certify the homes, the program plan for each of the homes, and then they are licensed by the Department of Social Services. We also have additional 24 homes for EBSH that are under development. Those are roughly 17 of them are in the north and central part of the state, and 7 of them are in the south. And we have the next homes that should be opening in the next one in August or September, with additional ones following soon thereafter. So that's a total combined capacity of 100 beds in the EBSH statewide that we currently have under development. For the community crisis homes, we currently have 11 homes that are under development for a combined capacity of 44 beds. Those are roughly delineated 8 for the north and the central part of the state, and south 3 for the Southern California, LA area, and San Diego. We are on the cusp of having the first community crisis home open, and we expect it to open in either August or September. And those regulations for those homes are still emergency regulations, and we're working on the final regulations for them. Any questions on EBSH for community crisis homes?
I'm just curious as to where the first community crisis home is being opened.
It's slated to open in North Bay's area.
Thank you.
Ron Cohen with UCP of LA. What is a community crisis home? How do you qualify to get in?
A community crisis home is meant to be an home for individuals who are in acute crisis and who need an immediate residence in the community. Like if an individual is not doing well in the family home, supported living, some other type of setting, and they're in crisis, then the community crisis home would be the place that they would go for not an extended period of time. It's time limited. The regulations allow up to 18 months with some additional months of approval by the director of the regional center, but they're meant to be an immediate resource in the community for folks who are in crisis.
Can I just expand on that a little bit, Brian? With a question, I can't expand substantively because I don't know the answers. But just before we came into office, or it might have been the first summer, the legislature enacted a moratorium on admissions to the developmental centers, which is part of what then I came later to bring this group together to address. And I think I recall that even with the moratorium, there were some circumstances where you could have an emergency admit at the developmental center. And my recollection of the things we've talked about here together was the recognition that in the absence of the DCs as we have known them, there would need to be something in the community where someone who would otherwise have met the conditions under the moratorium for immediate placement in a DC would have access, and there's been some talk about how many that might be needed and where they might be needed. Am I on track with where we are on this, and is that for shorthand in terms of Ron's question, roughly it would be someone who under our current circumstances would get an emergency placement in a DC?
Absolutely. That's our hope. We do have, of course, the acute crisis unit at Sonoma and at Fairview, and with only 10 beds statewide, we don't have enough capacity, and the community crisis homes are meant to fill that very immediate need when an individual is in crisis. Getting into Fairview or Sonoma takes a little bit more time than we'd like, and so our hope is that the community crisis homes will be a much more immediate resource.
This is an area that's a major concern, and thank you for giving us the status, because sometimes we heard the status and we thought they were already built. And I'd like it to keep abreast of all of the status of the development so I know what's available. I also saw in DDS's report a definition of, okay, there's crisis, and then now there's acute crisis. And I think it needs to be clearer, that because I had heard that you made an announcement that there's going to be a committee maybe formed for health and safety waiver, looking at the timeliness of those. And I'm very, very much interested in that. But I think the whole thing, so that the community can get a feeling of what really is a crisis and a timely resolve of how that happens. Now, we know there's only going to be one home available in the very, very near future, but I think if we have an idea of what the reality is, we can cope better as a community.
Mm-hmm. And it very much is what Secretary Dooley said. We don't have the resource of the developmental centers any longer, and we also, as a system, have been relying upon locked institutions for mental disease too heavily, quite honestly, and so the community crisis homes are meant to be that resource where individuals, when they go into a crisis, they can admit folks right away, as opposed to going to an IMD and obviously not a developmental center.
Well, actually, I testified to that because that was my nightmare. But I like in our paperwork that there's a lot of emphasis on meeting somebody's need in the place that they live. That's, you know, mobile crisis teams. That's what we really, really want, because it's much more timely. So thank you for that report.
Right, and we hope that individuals will be able to be served in the community crisis home and then transition back to their prior living arrangement if that is the best option for them, or once they come in, that transition planning will begin immediately, and if the prior option isn't available, that the team will begin to look at what is the best long-term solution for the person.
So right now, and maybe I'm on another subject, but what is the status of the mobile crisis teams?
Oh, you're
or is that later?
You're getting way ahead of us.
Okay. This is what happens when
they're
I come
not mobile
late.
Yet.
Okay, thanks.
Keisha and Christine.
Keisha Weather, State Council on Development and Disability. My questions are, what specific crises will admit you into, like, a home? Like, for example, is it a psychiatric emergency or is it, like, a medical emergency? What specific crisis will get you inside one of those homes?
Mm-hmm. Good question. So it could be a psychiatric emergency. It could be an issue that the individual is, maybe there's self-injurious behavior involved, or there's some sort of aggressive behavior involved, something that is precluding that individual from being successful in their current living arrangement. So it's pretty broad, and since we don't have the first homes open, we will have to see as we go along what those sorts of situations are, but we believe that they're going to be able to meet a very unique need in the community.
Can I like just to add a little on the community crisis homes? While we'd like to have them meet everybody's needs, I think we have to also be aware that there are times when an individual is an acute psychiatric, there's a need medically for intervention, and it may be that there's still a need to be able to have a hospitalization. And so at that time, we would want to make sure the person is getting the appropriate medical and support. So that will be really critical. So we don't see that the community crisis homes are going to be able to manage acute psychiatric needs when there's a need for a hospitalization, but they can be there immediately to be able to help transition a person upon stabilization to the community, so there's not a longer term time in an IMD, in an acute psychiatric hospital, longer that's necessary other than to do an immediate stabilization. So we do see that most individuals that may be going to an inappropriate setting right now will be able to use the community crisis option,
mm-hmm.
or if they do have to go for hospitalization, that we can immediately start transitioning them into the community to an option that can help them, like Brian said, get back to their original living environment or to help find a location that's the best next step.
That's fantastic, Nancy.
Thanks, Keisha.
Actually, what I have to say really ties in with you all, because I did testify a couple of years ago, I think, regarding the need for community crisis homes. And I remember, Brian, you were in a small group in Fresno with me, and you looked around the table and said, So tell me a little bit about what the need is for this community crisis thing. And I gave you my story about my son, and he was actually in a community group home. So this is not just for the folks that we're anticipating are going to have trouble transitioning from the DC. This, in my mind at least, should also be available for residents of group homes who have some acute crisis, such as my son did. He started attacking his good eye after blinding himself in the right. And it's a critical need because all we had available was emergency room, a psychiatric acute treatment facility, and then another psychological health facility. And then we were offered a lockdown mental institution, which I refused. And that's how Adam ended up in the D.C. So there was nothing in place 14 years ago. And so I just applaud your efforts so much to at least get a pilot program in place and see what we can see. It's hard to define what a crisis is until you are involved with one. And then it's pretty easy.
Will Sanford, question on geography. Given the fact that we have significantly more people in the southern part of the state, we have significantly more homes in the central and northern part, is that sort of in planning to sort of hopefully rectify? And I guess second piece of that is there also homes that are for over 18 and those under 18? Because I've heard from a number of families, especially of more folks on the spectrum or dual diagnosed who are teenagers who are now becoming very aggressive, and where do they have supports for the family? I mean, that's that crisis that's going to blow a family up as far as that. So I don't know what, it's just sort of the geographic piece, and then also do we have a age? So I know 18 is kind of the magic number.
Yeah, so we do have, as I stated, there are more homes in the north and central part of the state, but those homes are meant to also serve individuals statewide. So if a person is in crisis and needs that sort of stabilization, there's certainly no reason why they couldn't, go to a different geographic area. But we do need to continue to develop in Southern California for sure.
We also have Canyon Springs, which could be used as an option potentially also, or is that in the, that's just a transition to some degree. I don't know if we'd be able to use in that.
One of the things, when we look at the going into the safety net and the development of additional STAR homes, so we already have, as it was referenced, we have the North and the South. So we have North STAR, South STAR. We're developing, three more, that are going to be up in the North and then two in the South. In addition, part of the safety net, we also have with the transition homes. So for individuals that are in an IMD, and looking at, so kind of what, kind of responding to Keisha's question when I was talking about, making sure that there's resources available. So if somebody does have an acute psychiatric need for hospitalization, there are resources to transition folks out. So a person who's ultimately going to transition from an IMD, for example, they may be going back to the original option. And we want to make sure, we've heard from stakeholders, this is what the need is to make sure that there's options for support. But then also we had part of the budget and part of the safety net plan is to develop four intensive homes, community crisis homes, that are specifically for the purpose of supporting folks coming from IMDs. And there's going to be two of those homes in the South, recognizing that more individuals are in an IMD in Southern California, and then one in Central, and then one in the North. But as Brian is saying, that as we are looking at where services and crisis services, we have to remember that the development of resources, it hasn't just started in the last year or two. Regional centers have been developing resources for a number of years. And we are doing a crosswalk right now and looking at all crisis services in the state. So by regional center, what are the crisis services that are available, emergency response services from the county, what's available by each regional center, and then what's being developed. And then we're taking a look at how are those gaps. So when we're looking at the community placement plan request, how are we prioritizing based on if there's any gaps and making sure, to your point, is there a need for more in Southern California? Because as while we're talking about the community crisis homes, it's not saying there's not a resource already available, because there are quite a few resources already available in the community. We're enhancing what we have. So hopefully that'll help clarify.
Yes, well, I was going back. I know, I mean, several minutes ago, and Carlos really mentioned that we send someone to Porterville. I mean, that's, you might as well send them across country. It's like an 8-hour, 10-hour drive to get there. So it's really hard to connect supports back to the community. So moving someone to Northern California to move them back is one of that. That was just the question. It seems like we have more development, and obviously there's other homes that are probably out there that are supports for that. But that's really nice to fill out that picture for everybody to know what that is.
Any other questions?
Yeah, Marty.
Marty Emoto, CDCAM. First of all, thank you, you know, to the department and, you know, for moving forward on these issues. I know we've worked on it the last several years, and sometimes we forget that we proposed and wanted certain things, and it turns out that you guys are doing it, and then we're saying, why are you doing it that way? And but advocacy is circular. We always end up in the same place and usually move forward. So, but I have a question on the crisis services and homes, and I appreciate the fact that you said that it's enhancing, or we're trying to enhance what's already there. And this has been a long issue for all of us, that the community-based system hasn't seemed to be able to respond to crisis in the way that we feel has been able to respond in a developmental center, even though in those situations it hasn't been perfect either. But I know with my sister, your son, many of us across this table, there wasn't the adequate response over the years. And so hopefully this will do that. But one of the problems, though, is how do people know that this exists? I know a lot of people didn't even know there were mobile crisis units going around. That's not necessarily the fault of regional centers or anybody, but a lot of people don't know that there are crisis services even before we enhance them exist. And so the question is, well, the challenge is for all of us is that we need to do outreach in a better way to reach those families, to reach the advocates, to reach the service, everybody, to work together to make sure that people know that there are crisis services available and what are their options. And also, how does this tie in, and it needs to, everything we do, I've said this over and over, needs to reduce disparities. It needs to achieve the objectives that we have stated out as a community. One of them is to reduce disparities and to reduce unmet need. And crisis among communities of color is as great as any other community, if not greater. And so I definitely want to make sure that measurement is there. And lastly, you know, the crisis homes, it was established as a can't say no, right? We wanted some place where this a place could not say no. But the problem is someone can say no, because it's how one defines what a crisis is, or an acute crisis. And I guess my question is who's making sure that whoever's defining what that crisis is for a family or for a person saying they need this help, and then someone is saying, nope, it doesn't fit this definition. Well, then someone's saying no. And how do we know, where is the check on that? And that is partly addressed by good outreach, but also I think training among our community to know that that person who says, no, you don't meet the definition of crisis can be appealed and appealed really quickly. And not only that, there's a reporting or accountability measures put in place so others can really make sure that, you know, decisions are made in the right way. And I think also, you know, tied to all this is good training for and tools available to advocates, to regional centers, so that we work together on outreach and training and making sure that people understand and use this service appropriately. But I'm really concerned about that can't say no thing. And I know I'm looking at you, Connie, because I know this has been a big issue in your own life. But so those are actually questions. A couple of comments and questions.
Yeah, let me jump in here just for a minute, because you know, there are a lot of things that we have that are aspirational and things that we have that we can really do something about. And I'm a little bit concerned that in our aspiration that we have a can't say no environment, that we create false expectations. And listening to this conversation, I'm reminded of the years I spent in children's hospitals. Children's hospitals are for the most seriously ill and injured children, and they aren't everywhere. There isn't one on every corner. And being from the Valley, I was at Valley Children's Hospital in Fresno, and people came from 200-300 miles away for the services that they needed. And we had to say no a lot of the time. A parent with a neurological consult that couldn't get in for 5 months. As a parent, it broke my heart, but there was just a capacity issue. You can't have very specialized services available all the time for everyone. And while I completely agree that we need to have appeals and we have to meet standards and we have to have process for assuring that we do the greatest good for the greatest number as much of the time as possible, I just felt compelled to intervene and caution that we can't say no is a little bit difficult to operationalize because we have to say no to things we really want to do. And then sometimes they're legitimate, you know, where if you process it through and you don't always have the time to process through everyone's understanding of why no was the only option.
So I
just wanted to, just at my level, I'm not operational. I'm trying to help guide and create the environment to get the best results possible. But after several comments, I wanted just to make that.
This is Marty CDCan, and I actually agree with you. Maybe we should change it to can't say no all the time. But, you know, but I think the point that a lot of us are making, and we recognize there are limited resources, and the point of the whole addressing a crisis is to somehow, you know, you are going to say no to certain people who don't meet that definition. But I think the real issue is is that there seems to always be in the state of California, it's because of the size, and maybe there's, you know, it's always a factor. But there's disparities in how that's applied. So maybe the same crisis in, you know, Fresno might be addressed, but the same crisis in Eureka is not. Now, sometimes that's just going to happen because of geography. But I think one of the problems and one of the issues as advocates we will raise is that sometimes there's no sense in why someone is told no versus why someone's told yes. And if there was a sense behind it, then I think people could accept that, but often there is not. And sometimes it has to do with training and has to do with education and outreach of people understanding why a person could say no or what is a crisis.
And well, like I said about aspirations, I think that we absolutely have to have as much communication, as clear communication as we possibly can. But you know, having been in this job now for the years that I have and the efforts that I've made to rationalize and standardize programs all across, I mean, what you're saying about one region and another, I can't tell you how many times I've tried to intervene with licensing and certification and why an operator can be in one county and get one answer and an operator in another county who's, I mean, that same operator in another county thinks they're doing exactly the same thing. And I did that when I was at Valley Children's, you know, when we had TARS that went through and they went through in one county but not another. It's just a function of us as humans. We're imperfect. We have a range of ability and a range of interpretations. And so, again, the expectation is that we should have clear guidelines and we should encourage them to be followed and we should take action when they're not followed and we should do the best we can. But we're not going to be perfect. And your job is always going to be to let us know how we can be better. And our job is to be as good as we can be.
That's a good answer.
Connie and then Keisha and then.
So Connie Lathan, I appreciate your reality check.
And I think it's important for us all to hear. I mean, I like to get everything on the table so we can see what how to dream big and how to be reality-based. And I think many, I'll just say as a family member, I'm very reality-based. I mean, I've had my dreams, but I've also had the reality. But I think what's happening to our population because of the closure of the DCs is a huge paradigm shift. And that's why we need to understand even more. I mean, your analogy of the hospital, my son was at Children's Hospital, and I will never forget it. And it was not only for my son, but watching what happened in there. And I don't know how you do what you do, actually. But I think that we really have to bend over backwards because it's ingrained in us that there were always the DCs. Even though we didn't maybe want our children there or a person with a disability didn't want to end up there, that was, I hate the word now, safety net. I want another word because it's getting really used up a bit. But I think we need to understand the process because that's what I realized for my son who's severely challenged, what would be the alternative? And so I think we just need more information. I like what you said, Marty. I mean, and then with diverse communities. But we always had the DCs. And that's what makes this more challenging.
Teacher, what are St. Kent from a developmental disability? Definitely. Thank you.
Sorry about that.
I can hear you now.
Oh, definitely. Teacher, what are St. Kent from a developmental disability? My comment is that in terms of mobile crisis support teams, those things are so important because as a consumer in the regional center, I have had a chance to participate with those people, and they are excellent. And I just want to say that in terms of helping people find out about crisis support teams, and also different types of supports all around, all across the board. I think that we could do like an email blast and from DDS down, and also we could from regional center line staff when they go out on calls to interact with their clients on their caseloads, they could make sure to talk to your clients about what kind of crisis support the regional centers have, especially to people of diverse backgrounds, like Marty was saying, because the thing is that people of diverse backgrounds especially have more, in my opinion, more crisis need, more crisis support than people like occasions like myself because of what they have. And also, I have a question. What is a STAR home?
So the STAR home is the two homes, one in Northern and one in Southern California that is operated from Sonoma Developmental Center. And so it's for an individual who is in acute crisis that's needing support. And so it's an admission into a state-operated service where the supports are provided. And I don't remember what the acronym stands for.
Stabilization, training,
assistance, and reintegration. That's STAR. And so the one in the north, one in the south, state-operated.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for your comments.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Keisha, for your comments. And Marty, you know, just really quick, I've had the benefit of being a part of watching the DC task force work and the work of the DS task force and watching the development. So I started as the deputy director in 2012. And prior to that, I worked I worked over at a regional center in resource development for many years, and then I worked as a service provider. I have to say, when I look at the services, and we have a spreadsheet, and I thought I had it here. When we went around and talked with the stakeholders and said, let's take a look at what are the services, the array of services, because I agree, having a one-stop that can't say no, I think part of what we've talked about
is where are the services that are available for as many situations in which we can anticipate. And we've been able to add, you know, so many different services. And so we have the enhanced behavioral supports homes and community crisis homes. And we've been able to, with the benefit of the guidance, is to say, let's expand the STAR services. Let's take a look at mobile crisis from a state operated that will complement, that will be an added to what the regional centers are already doing. One of the things that I have heard through the stakeholder meetings that I'm hearing today is, how are we getting the communication out as to what those resources are? And again, we are pulling that thread through all the diversity and making sure that we're taking a look at the different languages that we're having information in, and we'll continue to make that a priority. But we have also have the regional centers. Every regional center has an emergency line. There's a point of contact that everybody knows. It's a common thread with every single regional center. And from there, you know, while we still need to get the information out, we have to remember that there is a point that every person is informed about, that they can make a phone call, whether it's a family member, whether it's a provider. So I just kind of want to put that out there that while we can improve, there is already a system in place. I don't know if Carlos and Heather, you have anything else to add to that? Are you feeling that I'm incorrectly representing you?
So I've been the chair of the Mental Health Task Force for 20 years, and we've been dealing with these issues for 20 years. I think in the past 5 years, we've accelerated. We've done 10 times more than we did in the previous 15 years on this issue. So I do applaud this process and the department and the regional centers. You know, this is a really tough issue. When you get a crisis out there, a crisis in Eureka, where I've worked, is very different than how you respond to it than a crisis in San Diego. Because there are no psychiatric hospitals in Eureka, anywhere in that area. So we do need to think statewide and meet the needs across the state. We need to do it systematically. I've been saying that for 20 years. We need to do an analysis of where the needs are across the state and put those resources in those areas according to community need, because that's how regional centers were built, to respond to community need back in 66. So I'm actually very happy with the progress. We have a long way to go, but we are continuing to work with the department in creating those resources and trying to work out the systems and the systemic issues. So we're not there yet, but I'm pleased with the process.
Thanks, Carlos. Christine?
Yes. Oh, it's right here. All righty. So we're talking about a lot of things today that I previously testified about. Let me preface this by just telling you that my experience with Adams Community Placement this time around is vastly different from my experience 14 years ago. People are just eager to work with me to make it work, and that just feels so great, and I do believe he's doing well. But I have to ask you this question. Has anything changed as far as the rule that says that a group home operator, any vendor, can just give 30 days notice that they can no longer provide services for an individual, and then that individual has to transition to another placement? Is that still in place?
There's not a rule that says that a notice cannot be given, and it's all, it's been a lot of years since I've worked in it. So I would have Heather and Carlos correct me, but in the placement agreement, there's identification, but services still have to be provided to an individual. And the person, the service provider that's providing those services, for as long as the person is under their care, they're responsible for those services.
Right.
You know, so, Carlos, he's giving me that look.
Well, technically it's true, but we run into situations where the person's behavior is such a danger to self or others that they're in a psychiatric hospital and service providers refuse to have them come back. So those are the situations we're talking about, and building the safety nets. Sorry, Connie. So it's really important to build those types of safety nets when those things happen. Because in reality, the service provider is not equipped to deal with those situations when coming from a psychiatric hospital. So what are the options? That's what we need to work on.
And honestly, it's that feedback through the stakeholder process that we've had and the discussions that we've had that built the idea to the mobile STAR team, you know, that's looking at each of the regional centers, what are the mobile teams that are available. So to help support those unique situations, there's times when providers have said, if I just have help for the next 30 to 60 days, you know, kind of get over this hurdle, you know, and build the supports, we're going to be fine. So it's, again, just trying to make sure that we're building those supports in the times when somebody just needs that added support. So it is a little bit different than what we've been able to do in the past, but keep the feedback coming.
Dana.
Dana Hooper. And I guess I just wanted to acknowledge that probably 2 years ago, we were talking, conceptualizing these two models, and here it is 2 years later, where 11 homes and 24, one open, another in the other category going to be open. I mean, it may never be fast enough or big enough or good enough, but I just wanted to acknowledge how much I appreciate, and I think all of us in the task force appreciate seeing these positive steps forward. And I think I would also echo what Carlos said, is that this is probably more actual stuff dealing with real issues, you know, over the last few years than we'd seen for many years. And so thank you for that progress. And I hope that the next question is, you know, is 11 enough, right? And where should the 12th be? And at least have some sort of a basis of experience and to be able to move forward to take the next step. But to get to this step is really pretty special. So thank you.
Wayne Bradshaw, Res Coalition. To get back to Christine's question with regards to the 30-day notice issue, we are seeing a change in the community over the past 2 years where community care licensing, and it really depends on the specific licensing agency throughout the state, but with the new Medicaid waiver requirements, they're beginning to come back and say, hey, you need to be able to justify and explain this 30-day notice. And we're actually seeing some providers getting cited for giving a bad 30-day notice now. So I would advocate there's a beginning to be a change in this just blanket 30-day notice of I don't want to deal with the problem anymore into a much more cohesive system, which is geared more towards what we've been discussing. So I would say, honestly, 2 more years, we're going to have a really concrete answer to where that's at.